Today, forget affordable housing for generations. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, World's latest post covering finance and property news. The data doesn't lie. Housing is more out of reach for more Australians than ever before, whether renting or purchasing via a mortgage. The gap between incomes and home prices have gone through the roof, and households are spending more than ever on trying to house themselves. Over the past 20 years, property has risen at a compounded annual rate of 5.4%, and the result, an intergenerational chasm in wealth and opportunity, with younger Australians increasingly locked into rental cycles or forced to rely on parental support to buy a home. But wait, we have an election campaign full of housing-related promises, so surely this will be turned around super quick, no? Well, no, not a chance, actually. While political leaders are pitching bold promises and glittering schemes to help young Australians climb the property ladder, behind the buzzwords and voter-friendly slogans, the numbers tell a far, far bleaker story. Actually, 70 years. Australia could be waiting until 2095 to see housing become truly affordable again, if you're lucky. Even though the policy platforms may sound promising, they are actually confused political spin, especially against the promise from both major parties that they want to see home prices rise further, not fall towards being more affordable. "I want to see home prices steadily increase," Dutton said in the second leaders' debate. "I don't want to see a situation where Labour crashes the economy and somebody who's paid $750,000 for a house today is worth $600,000 in 18 months' time under an Albanese-backed government. That would be a disaster." Albanese, whilst less direct, echoed a similar sentiment during a radio interview. "Historically in Australia, prices tend to rise. What we want to do is to make sure that people have accessibility for home ownership." Neither man wants to say what is plainly understood by those locked out of the market. If home prices keep going up, so does the bar to entry. Looking briefly at the main policies, the Labour Party has promised to expand the first home buyer guarantee scheme so that from January 2026, all first home buyers, regardless of income, will be eligible to purchase a home with a 5% deposit and so avoid lenders' mortgage insurance, which can save buyers somewhere around $20,000, while the government will guarantee the remaining 50% of the loan. This aims to broaden access to the market, but it will increase demand and therefore further inflate house prices, as well as expose taxpayers to additional risks if prices were ever to fall. On the social and affordable housing front, they have pledged $10 billion to build 100,000 homes over 8 years in partnership with state governments and developers, but this is too slow to address immediate supply constraints, and of course their 1.2 million target of homes to be built is lagging simply because there are not enough people capable of building. And note the silence relating to the rental sector, where affordability is shot, and 35% of households are found there. But hey, ALDA did confirm that there are no plans to rein in negative gearing and other tax breaks for property investors, so investors rejoice at least. Well, really? But then, the Liberal National Coalition is no better. They announced tax deductions on mortgage interest, so first home buyers will be able to claim tax deductions on interest paid on mortgages up to $650,000 for newly constructed homes, with income caps of $125,000 for individuals and $250,000 for couples. This has been framed as an incentive to encourage new housing supply, though it still will drive prices higher without a matching supply response. And of course, it puts more pressure on the broader tax take, as it'll need to be funded from general taxation. And again, they are explicitly opposed to house price falls, even if it's positioned as sustainable growth, slow price rises that lag behind wages growth. And they're pushing the idea that people could raid their superannuation for a deposit with some conditions, and there is vague talk of migration limits, but the numbers are at best wobbly. The Greens seem to be wanting house price stagnation to ease affordability over time, which means they would support house prices staying roughly flat while wages rose. That's a middle ground between inflation and sharp price drops, but that'll take at least 20 years to return to the early 2000 affordability under the plan. And because they also support migration, the big Australia, where more people demand property, could well mean that they will never achieve this vague goal. And by the way, it's well beyond the election cycle in any case. They do advocate more ambitious public and affordable housing bills than Labour or the Coalition, and they have called for large-scale public housing investment. But of course, that's going to cost taxpayer money. And they also support rent control, like in the ACT, vacancy tax, and limits on property investors to ease pressure on the market. And as for the independents and cross voices like the Teals and the Central Alliance, there are a range of policies out there which are somewhat varied, but generally they seem to support zoning and planning reform to encourage higher density housing. And they also are advocates for climate resistance, affordable housing initiatives, and seem to be open to reining in negative gearing and capital gains tax concessions to cool investor-driven growth. But it's all horribly vague. Economist Saul Eslake has called out what he sees as the central delusion, the idea that affordability can be restored purely by letting incomes catch up to prices. This might sound nice, but it's actually a con, he said in The Guardian. Let's do the maths. At the end of 2024, the median capital city house price was $933,000. That's 12.8 times the average adult income of $73,000 back in 2000. The ratio was 6.5, with a median house costing just $178,000. Now, assuming house prices grow by 2.5% annually, that's in line with the Reserve Bank's inflation target, and wages grow by 3.5%, that ratio won't return to 6.5 until 2095. That is, assuming the economy behaves perfectly for seven decades. And as Eslake dryly observes, even then, factoring in house price growth of only 2.5% a year is, well, a heroic assumption. Australia's political and economic system has quietly but decisively placed home ownership at the centre of its wealth-building engine. Nearly every government of the past two decades has offered grants, tax breaks, or deposit assistance schemes for home builders, but those policies have often managed to inflate prices further, helping buyers bid up property and enriching those already in the market. And of course, the banks love it because they can lend more and, of course, are advocates for lending even more in the future. Ironically, the very policies that are being touted as solutions, such as the first home buyer grants from both major parties, are recycled versions of measures that contribute to the problem in the first place. And a recent report from the Productivity Commission highlighted again that these do not help the people in the most need. Throwing more taxpayer money at the housing bubble is utterly reckless, of course, Leif Van Onselen said recently in response to Labour's latest scheme to drop the 20% deposit requirement for first home buyers. You can see that show on my channel. The Coalition's counteroffer, tax deductions on mortgage interest for newly built homes, is equally fraught. Without a plan to boost construction, it simply channels more money into an already tight market. Prices, they go up. Australia's love affair with property does run deep. For most households, their home is their biggest asset. Excluding superannuation, residential property accounts for the majority of household wealth. That mindset is politically potent. There's 11 million Australians who own property and 2.25 million hold investment properties. Only a few hundred thousand people attempt to enter the market every year. The electoral arithmetic is clear. Protecting existing owners is good politics, even if it's bad policy. And Eslake, therefore, along with other economists, concedes that a sudden plunge in house prices would be disruptive and potentially catastrophic if driven by unemployment or economic collapse, as happened in Spain, Ireland, and the United States after the global financial crisis. But he argues that a controlled fall in prices of 5 to 10% over 3 years would do more to boost affordability than anything any government has done in the past 60 years. Governments may not be able to engineer that outcome, but Eslake insists they must stop actively resisting it. At very least, he said, they should not step in to prop up prices when they start to decline, which is exactly what they've done in the past. And as house prices soar and affordability metrics reach historic lows, there are more people beginning to ask whether reining in immigration could provide a circuit breaker Australia has experienced the fastest population growth among advanced economies this century, a trend that has fueled demand for housing and outpaced supply. According to projections from the Centre of Population, the national population is expected to swell by another 13.5 million over the next 40 years, effectively adding another Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane. And again, Leith has argued that this is unsustainable. He contends that instead of encouraging further price rises to entice developers, as some industry figures like Michael Yarnley has proposed, Australia should confront the demand side of the equation. He outlines a compelling case: reducing immigration could allow housing supply to catch up, lifting rental vacancy rates, slowing rent inflation, and helping prospective buyers save for deposits more quickly. Perhaps more critically, fewer new arrivals would ease direct upward pressure on home prices, making ownership a more realistic goal for younger Australians. The logic is simple. Fewer people competing for the same housing stock would translate to softer prices, or at the very least, slower growth. But in contrast, Yardney argues that developers won't build unless home prices rise 15 to 20%, claiming that profitability is essential to addressing the shortage. But it's worth highlighting that relying on high prices to spur supply is a double-edged sword. It might incentivize development, but it deepens the affordability crisis in the short term and locks out the very people policies claim to help, and of course piles more and more people into high-rise that it really is not great to live in. Now, there are case studies out there for people who want to see them. After increasing net overseas migration to unprecedented levels, Canada, for example, experienced a similar housing shortage. Those factors too drove rental vacancies to record lows and rental inflation to all-time highs. But Canada's government last year implemented a three-year population immigration freeze. And last year, it aimed to maintain Canada's population at its current level of 41.6 million. As a result, the number of temporary migrants in Canada declined in the fourth quarter of 2024. Accordingly, Canadian asking rents have fallen for six straight months. This immigration freeze has brought Canadian housing construction back into line with population growth, eroding Canada's housing shortage. And over at the ditch in New Zealand, specifically Auckland, facing its own affordability crunch, New Zealand's city embarked on a radical rezoning initiative, lifting height limits and increasing density. The result? Well, more apartments, more construction, and in relative terms, lower prices and rents than the rest of the country. But again, it was a change in migration policy which really changed the game, and prices have been falling and rents have become more affordable. So, as the election campaign rolls on, there is no shortage of talk about supporting first home buyers, but whether it's grants, deposit guarantees or tax breaks, the central tenet of housing policy remains unchanged: demand-side handouts with minimal supply-side reform. Unless that changes, the idea of affordable housing will remain just that, an idea, a flickering dream that floats further into the future with each passing year. And by the time that future arrives, sometime around 2095, some of today's renters may no longer be around to enjoy it. And yet, no one major party leader has dared to suggest that house prices should fall, a silence that speaks volumes. They are playing politics, not really wanting to tackle what is a housing crisis, which is set to run for years. And as S. Lake put it, and I want to underscore this again, one is left to wonder, why do parties of both major political persuasions keep doing things that they know will put upward pressure on house prices and thus exacerbate the problem they say they are trying to solve? It's hard to avoid the conclusion that the reason is that they know that there are only about 110,000 people who each year succeed in becoming first home buyers. And even if you assume that for everyone who does, there are five or six who don't, that's still only 700,000 or so votes, tops, for policies that may restrain the rate of house price inflation or hold it altogether. Politicians also know that at any point in time, there are more than 11 million voters who own their own home and more than 2.25 million who own at least one investment property. The last thing those 11 million to 30 million voters want is anything that might restrain, let alone hold, the rate of property price inflation. So on one hand, 700,000 votes. On the other, something north of 11 million. Even the dumbest of our politicians can do that math, and they certainly do. So I say, a plague on all their houses, as Shakespeare nearly said. That's a curse uttered by the dying Mercutio, as he blames both the Capulet and Montague families for his death. On housing, we need better, and we need it now. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. May thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.